gives me great, great pleasure to introduce this man who has one of the most powerful messages to deliver that any of us have ever heard. Thank you very much. Bill Cooper.
Thank you, Eve. Thank you, Eve. I hope I can live up to that. Does that work okay from here? Anybody here?
I had to bring it up closer.
Okay. Is that better? How's that? Okay. Good.
I think it might too.
Yeah, okay, great. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here tonight to bring you some revelations, so to speak. We've been asleep for many, many years, and it's time now for us to wake up. And it's time for us to wake up, not in fright, not to look around and jump back from the shadows, but to come awake with our eyes open, realizing what stands in front of us and what we must do so that we can live our lives again in peace and tranquility. And we must, at all costs, guard against drifting back into the slumber that we have been in for the last 40 to 50 years. That has really created the situation that we find ourselves in today. We're going to be discussing a lot of subjects tonight, and I would like for you to hold your questions until the end, at which time I will be happy to answer them. The harder the question, the more I like it. There's no such thing as a dumb or stupid question. And while I'm imparting this information to you tonight, I want you to try to come up with questions to poke holes in it. And I'm going to answer every one of those questions, because when you leave here tonight, I don't want you to have any doubts in your mind whatsoever about the truthfulness of what you're about to hear. Because it is so important not only that you understand it and believe it, but that you act upon it, so that we can do something about it. We tried to get a large television set tonight, and lo and behold, in the entire city of Sedona, this is the largest we could get. So if you'll bear with us, I'm going to be showing you some videotapes. Most of them we're going to play through once, because the audio will be enough for those of you who aren't able to see it from the back. When I get to the Kennedy tape, if you are unable to see what you need to see, after we play it the first time, let me know. We will then ask the people in the front to stand up and move back, and those of you in the back come forward. We will play it through as many times as we need to. It is important that you know that you've been lied to, that your own government assassinated one of our presidents. And we're going to show that to you tonight. I would like to thank some people now and talk about some material that you're going to be seeing here in the future. I would like to thank especially Eve Bruce, who through long distance telephone conversations really started this rolling and was the one who put it together for you. I would like to also thank Mr. Ed DeMar, who was sort of in partnership with Eve to bring this about and did an awful lot of work on it, and who has written a book called Lese Majesty. It's by Ed DeMar, and it covers or concerns, a lot of the material that I'm going to discuss tonight, and a lot of the things that Colonel James Bogreitz is talking about across the nation. I read a good portion of Mr. DeMar's book this morning, and I have to tell you, it is one of the most in-depth, most well-researched, most well-referenced works of its kind that I have seen, and includes the best bibliography on this subject, which is available for all of you here tonight. You can pick up this bibliography from the table back here, and the reason we put it out for you to pick up is because most of what I'm going to tell you tonight, you can find out for yourselves through your own research. Most of the information that I'm going to give you is not secret. It has been in the public domain for many years. However, we have been extremely, trying to think of a nice word for it, but I can't. The word is really negligent. Asleep. We have abdicated our role as the watchdogs of our government. Instead of reading, instead of questioning, we watch television, we believe everything that Dan Rather tells us, amongst others. He is just one. There are many, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about that later. Who lie to you every night on the 6 o'clock news and the 11 o'clock news? So that we get started off on the right foot, I'd like to preface my talk with something I think you need to hear to put you in the proper frame of mind and keep you, I hope, from becoming afraid. Fear is a worse enemy than any other thing that we have to face. Ladies and gentlemen, the world needs to hear the truth. It's long overdue. The world also needs more peace, compassion, and cooperation. We already have too much fear and confusion. And too many people are feeling hopeless and victimized. What is offered here is startling information. And what we ask is that if you choose to accept it, you do so with the understanding that it would not come to our attention now if we did not have the ability to successfully respond. But successful only if we bring our highest thoughts, energies, and feelings to take positive action. We are not here to create more confusion, fear, or negative energies of any kind. And it is important that we not give in to these in ourselves, as it would only add to what the world already has. Fearing and fighting is the old way. We've tried to change the world, and the result has been that those who managed to be the victors brought the same constrictive and negative patterns back into power. We have now come to the threshold of a new understanding, that we must fight fear with confidence, hatred with love, separateness with unity, and beliefs of being a helpless victim with the acknowledgement and acceptance of the power we have to create our own lives and then the world. It can only go in that order. For if we are still creating confusion and negativity in our own experience, we can only contribute that to the world. We can change the world. But it will not be by outward action alone. To the extent we can bring truthfulness, compassion, and peace in our own lives is the exact extent to which we will bring them into the world. This does not mean that we have to sit in our rooms until we perfect our own lives, but to realize that if we see ourselves as victims, we will be victimized. If we perceive part of the world as separate, wrong, or evil, that is exactly what we will have. This story was beautifully played out in Star Wars. Luke had to gain his own inner power first by his belief in his connectedness with all things, and could only succeed in battle by not giving in to negative feelings. The problems that have arisen in our world have come as a reflection of our own collective fears, beliefs in separateness, and refusal to accept our own power and responsibility for the events in our lives. If we give in to these same feelings again, the battle will be lost before it is begun. Now, I want you to bear that in mind. I want you to bear in mind that what has happened over the years, we bear a major part or portion of the responsibility. And it is up to us, in the abdication of others, to correct the situation, to correct it. We are powerful. Each and every one of us is worthy, is powerful, has great potential to change the world. If you look back through history, you will find at least 27 incidences that I can pinpoint where one man or one woman has changed the entire world. If you doubt your ability to successfully act and change the world, I challenge you to re-examine that belief, and I challenge you to stand up, take action, and I guarantee you that you will be amazed at the power that you really, really have. Ladies and gentlemen, what I'm talking about tonight began many years ago, 250 years ago to be exact. This is not something that has happened overnight. This is not something that's going to go away overnight. But it is something that we can begin to work on. And we can make major changes before the end of this year. And before the night is over, that is going to be my challenge to you. And my commission to you is to help us bring about those changes. And I'll tell you exactly what those are. I'm going to brush over the brief history of this because what I want to do is get to the meat of the matter that's happening today, because that's really what concerns us. But you need to know how it all started. About 250 years ago, there was a man who was contacted by, you might call it a channel, you might call it an alien being, you might call it a spirit, whatever you call it. This entity that contacted this person set in motion one of the most far-reaching, longest-lasting conspiracies known to man. It began with the Illuminati. It began with the Illuminati right from the inception of the Illuminati as a plot to depose the rulers of the countries of the world, take down the national barriers, create a one-world government with the core members or executive members of the Illuminati at its head, concentrating the power of the world and the wealth of the world in their hands and subjugating the rest of the human race literally to serfdom. When the heads of the monarchs of the countries of Europe uncovered this plot accidentally, they immediately banned the Illuminati. They put a price on the head of the members of the Illuminati, and they quickly disappeared and took to the holes in the ground. They were sheltered by other secret groups. You will find that all of the secret societies that are concerned with this particular conspiracy, all through the years, always have levels of initiation for their membership. I'll explain to you why that is a little bit later. This is really a European thing, but it has spread to the United States. The major controlling membership of these secret societies is a group known as the Round Table of Nine. They are the heads of the most powerful banking families in the world. When you get right down to it, there are only nine families who control the wealth of the world, and that is the nine families whose heads make up the Round Table of Nine. Beneath the Round Table of Nine, there's an international organization known as the Bilderbergers. The Bilderbergers are a major player in this. Beneath the Bilderbergers, each nation has its own group. Most of the European nations look to the Club of Rome. In the United States, it's the Council on Foreign Relations, and in recent years, in our generation, the Trilateral Commission. You may not realize this, but they are one and the same. The Trilateral Commission branched off from the Council on Foreign Relations to give you something to hang on to should they lose political power. It is an old ploy. It's the same as in the playoffs for Major League Football. You have two teams and you play yourself. You cannot lose. That is the theory behind the split. Now that you know a little bit of the history, and not too much, because I really want you to go start reading for yourself, and you will find that there's plenty of material to give you food for thought, a lot of hours of reading, and a lot of productive research. Our story really started in around 1936 when Germany recovered a flying disc. It is not clear whether they entered into an agreement with the aliens and were given the disc, or whether they took the disc, or whether the disc crashed and they just came in possession of it. The method by which they did this is not clear. It is clear, however, that they had a disc as early as 1936, that they were attempting to duplicate the technology in an area known as Peenemünde. When we went into that area after World War II, and captured Peenemünde, we found safes, file cabinets, drawers loaded with documents on the alien technology and on the attempts to reproduce the technology. We found pieces and portions of hardware. We found some of the scientists in our sweep trying to recover them. Many of them, however, were captured by the Russians. Much of the hardware was also captured by the Russians, and the Russians may have captured the original disc, because we certainly didn't get it, to my knowledge. Notice I say to my knowledge, because I was not privy to every scrap of information. When we found this at the close of World War II, we were extremely concerned. We didn't know what to do about it, but we immediately set the scientists about working on trying to duplicate the technology, or at least come up with it on our own. Most of it we did not have to duplicate until 1947, when, as you probably read or heard, or recently if you watched Unsolved Mysteries last Wednesday on television, you saw what was described as the Roswell incident. The Roswell incident is a true incident. It did occur. It occurred near the city of Roswell, New Mexico. And what actually happened, there was a thunderstorm. A disc was seen flying over two cities in the direction where the wreckage was found. The disc either exploded in the air or hit something in the air. But whatever happened, we know it happened in the air, because debris was found in two different locations. There were large amounts of small debris scattered over a ranch that belonged to a Mr. Brazel, who was an old-time cowboy, was a very honest man, and reported it. Several miles away, there was a large, intact majority of the saucer, actually, or the disc, found on the ground with several dead alien bodies. The reason I say several is there are accounts that there were four. I saw pictures of three of those dead alien bodies in a report called Project Grudge, which also included material from a report called Blue Book Report Number 13. So, I'm not sure whether there were three or four. I saw photographs of three of those bodies for sure. Really, it doesn't make any difference if there was one or 50. The important thing is that it occurred and that there were dead alien bodies that were not of this world. The technology was not of this world. We could find nothing within that craft that we knew anything about. We could not find electrical wires, we could not find vacuum tubes, we could not find hydraulic actuators, accumulators, control valves. We didn't know what made this thing tick. Immediately, it was classified secret. It was carted away. The press was told, first, that they had recovered a flying saucer. Second, that no, it wasn't a flying saucer, it was a weather balloon. When the local newspaper tried to put it out on the wire service was interrupted, and a message came across the wire to the local news service stating that they were to cease transmission immediately. What they were transmitting concerned the national security. The message was from the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And this is documented. The witnesses are still alive and have so testified to this fact. What happened over the next several years, really that's the most important thing that initially happened. The second most important thing that happened, and there were other crashes in between, the second most important thing that happened is that we found two discs in the vicinity of Aztec, New Mexico in 1948, which contained human body parts. Now, this caused the classification to go from secret to way above top secret because there was a great fear of a national panic. Now, this was before they ever did a study to determine whether or not they believed the populace would panic if the information that aliens here were here was disseminated. But they knew that if they told the public, or if it got out to the public by some means, that aliens were not only here, but were flying around in craft which contained human body parts, that's another story altogether. Now, I don't want you to get real concerned about this, because your chances of being affected by it personally are extremely remote. The next really important occurrence was the fact that in 1949, again near Roswell, two discs crashed. They recovered five alien bodies from these discs, and in combing the area to make sure that they had recovered all of the wreckage and everything that they could so that the public would not be able to discover anything, and so that they would have everything with which to gain knowledge and technology from, they scoured the area by foot patrol, by jeep patrol, and by aircraft reconnaissance, and discovered an alien live from the crash wandering in the desert. They captured him. He was designated EB, extraterrestrial biological entity. EB was taken to Los Alamos, where he was placed in a Faraday shielded environment. Because he had the ability to read the thoughts and transmit thoughts to people outside of where he was being held captive, he also had the ability through a device that he wore around his waist to literally walk through walls. Now, we know through our own study of science that this is not far-fetched. We know that mass or matter is made up of molecules, which are made up of atoms. And in between these atoms, there's quite a large space on that scale. And in between the molecules, there is a large space on that scale also. It's much like being out in space and looking at the solar system. If the sun and each of the planets, if you were to consider them to be molecules, if you could get way down microscopically and look inside your own hand, you would see much the same thing. There are large spaces between them. They're held together by a force or an energy, which we know very little about. With the proper technology, you could literally put your hand through your other hand if you knew how to do that. The aliens apparently do, because they can not only walk through walls, but they are apparently able to abduct you from your bed in the middle of the night and lift you out through your ceiling without opening any doors, without lifting the roof, without opening any windows, and you pass right through it with no ill effects, and they can put you right back down in your bed in the same manner. Now this sounds totally insane, doesn't it? Doesn't it really? Because I have to tell you, quite frankly, when I was reading this material, and when I was studying the abductee reports, and when I first came across this, I thought it was crazy. I thought it was insane, until I realized that it was absolutely real. I want you to also bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, that it was not too long ago, and it really wasn't too long ago, that if you mentioned to someone else that in a few years man would be flying through our own atmosphere, you would have been laughed at, ostracized, and probably kicked out of town. Then not long after that, when we did have aircraft and were carrying passengers flew through the air, if you had suggested to your neighbor that in a few years a man would be walking on the moon, you would have been laughed at, ridiculed, and maybe run out of town. Literally, when we put a man on the moon is when I realized that nothing is impossible. Nothing ever again can be impossible. The next most important thing that happened after they found EB, it came a few years later. EB became ill, and they tried to save him. They were unsuccessful. They didn't know how to go about it. But in an attempt to save him, and also in an attempt to gain favor with this technologically superior race, they began broadcasting out into space for help. We have one of your people here who crashed in one of your ships. We're trying to save his life. He's dying. Please help us save his life. By doing that, they hoped, number one, to make contact, number two, to make friendly contact, number three, that the aliens would see us as a benevolent people trying to help one of theirs and would not attempt to destroy us or hurt us. Because we realized that their technology was so far ahead of ours that in any military confrontation of any kind, we would have had no chance whatsoever. And basically that is still true today. What should give you good feelings is that if the aliens wanted to, they could have done anything that they wished to us many, many years ago, and they have not done that. So I see that as good. Hopeful. I see it pregnant with all kinds of hope and possibilities for the future. Because we know as the human race, what we usually do to an inferior culture, if we're technologically superior, is usually not that good. So there is a great deal of hope. There's a great deal of promise in that. EB died in June of 1952. As of the time of EB's death, we had not had any answer to the message that we had sent out into space. The movie that you saw called E.T. is the story of E.B. They have changed some things around to make it more palatable to you. The beginning of the story, he's running around in the desert. He's lost. The government is chasing him. In the real story, the government caught him. In the movie, the little boy gets him. And they form this symbiotic relationship. They're each getting something from the other. And it's a wonderful story. Well, in real life, the real life E.B. was assigned an Air Force officer to watch over him, become his friend, get as much information from him as he could, be his mentor, be his captor. And the same symbiotic relationship developed between E.B. and this Air Force officer, to the point where when E.B. died, the Air Force officer cried. He was deeply hurt. He'd lost a dear friend, because he had been with E.B. literally night and day since they had found him. In the movie, E.B. gets very ill, and everybody's very concerned. And the little boy plays the role of the Air Force officer. And you see that he cries. But in the film, he lives. E.T. Call Home was Project Sigma to attempt to make communications with the aliens to come and help save the life of E.B. The government, ladies and gentlemen, is giving you information at an unprecedented rate every day. They are trying to get to your subconscious and tell you the story of what has happened over the last 44 years. So that when the truth comes out, it is not a critical shock. You will be prepared for it. You will understand what is happening. In 1953, we detected large objects in space coming toward the Earth. They took up a high orbit around the equator. These objects were determined to be spacecraft intelligently controlled. We did establish communications with them. Arrangements were made for them to land. There were three landings in 1954. One took place at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico. One took place at Edwards Air Force Base in California. The other one, do not hold me to this because I cannot substantiate it, but I believe it was at Homestead Air Force Base in Florida. I believe that the aliens who contacted us, who were attempting to help us, who refused to give us technology, who wanted to help us with our spiritual development, I believe that that landing took place at Homestead Air Force Base in Florida. But I can't get any verification from that from any source, so don't put that down as fact, put it down as a possibility. The other two bases, the other two landings I know occurred without a doubt at Holloman Air Force Base and Edwards Air Force Base. The first landing occurred at Holloman Air Force Base, where the aliens met with our intelligence officers. They reached a basic agreement after several hours. They were able to communicate. They left one hostage with us. His name was Krill, as a pledge that they would return and formalize an agreement. Later in 1954, they landed again at Edwards Air Force Base. President Eisenhower had arranged to be on vacation in Palm Springs. At the appointed date and time, President Eisenhower was whisked away. He actually disappeared. Nobody even saw the helicopter come or go, but he just flat disappeared. The press was really shook up. And if you read the newspapers during that period of time, you will find that the press literally went wild trying to locate him. They were given a story that he was taken to a dentist for a toothache. They never found a dentist that treated President Eisenhower. In fact, he was at Edwards Air Force Base. He reached a formal agreement with the aliens and a treaty was signed. This was played out in a movie that you saw called Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Everything that you saw in that movie, except for finding the ship in the desert and the plains in Mexico and those types of things, was true. People were and are still being abducted. People were and are still being picked up and relocated, decontaminated, brainwashed, given new identities, and put back into society in some other location. It's for their own protection, really. In most cases, in some cases, it's a travesty of justice. People are being implanted. The implants were played out by the silly little tune that people got in their head. That represented the implants. They couldn't get this out of their head. They would have a close encounter with an alien disc, and they would hear this tune, and they could never ever get rid of it. And it drove them to do some crazy things. And there are people today who are being driven to do some crazy things. I know some abductees who wake up one morning after they've had an abduction experience, and they've got to move. And they've got to move to a specific place in a specific state, and they've got to do it right now. And they don't know why. And they've never been there before. And they have no friends there. They don't even know what the place looks like, but they get all their kids. They pack up, and they leave, and they go to Sedona, Arizona. Some of them go to Yelm, Washington. There are areas in the United States where people are being driven to. They don't know why they're going to these places, but they're going there. Usually they have been abducted. Usually they have been implanted. Well, let me take that back. I guarantee you that everyone who has been abducted has been implanted. And the time that I saw the information between 1970 and 1973, the official Office of Naval Intelligence figures was 1 in 40, which works out to 2.5% of the population. How did they get these figures? It's very simple, ladies and gentlemen. At that time, they still had the draft. At that time, they had draft quotas from every state representing a certain percentage of the population. A certain percentage of the population of young men had to be drafted according to the percentage of the total population that lived in that state. When they came in for induction into the military service, they were given an extensive medical examination, and even at that time, ladies and gentlemen, we did have magnetic resonance imaging capability, but the military did not put it out to the civilian community as yet. This was a new technique, a new development. They found that according to the number of implants they found in the military inductees, based upon the percentage of the population of that state from which they were taken, that the number of people in the United States who had been implanted was 1 in 40. I sincerely believe that that was an underestimate, maybe a large underestimate, simply because now today most of the abductees are women, and that sampling was taken from only men. Why they're mostly women, I don't know. It has something to do, I do know, and this may not be the only reason, and that's why I say I don't know what the whole reason is. It has something to do with the attempts for them to preserve their race in an attempt to crossbreed with human beings, either as a direct attempt by implanting or impregnating the female and allowing the baby to come to the first trimester, at which point they're abducted again and the fetus is removed, or by harvesting sperm and ova from selected human beings and attempting to grow this crossbreed in the laboratory. There is tremendous evidence to support this. Now, let me digress back again to the next major step that happened was that in 1954, when President Eisenhower became incumbent with the office, he realized that he was going to have to deal with this, and he also realized, as I realized a long time ago, you can't believe what's happening. You can't believe what the aliens tell us. whether they be good, bad, etherical, interdimensional, whatever. There is so much deception and so many lies involved with this that you have to step back and say, I'm not going to believe anything until I can prove it. And to do otherwise is to put yourself in terrible jeopardy. Believe me, terrible jeopardy. And I can cite instances where this has happened. President Eisenhower knew that he wasn't capable of determining what the truth was, but he knew that there was some pretty smart people in this country. He put together an organization called MJ-12, or Majority 12. Majority 12 was made up of 6 men from the United States government. Those 6 men were Nelson Rockefeller, who represented the president, who was the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, the Director of the CIA, the Director of the FBI, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The balance of MJ-12 was made up of the Executive Committee of the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, it is extremely significant that you understand that the first 6 members from the government, along with President Eisenhower, were also members and longtime members of the Council on Foreign Relations. They believed in that organization. They believed in its goals, which was one world government. Now, secretly, this was known as Majority 12. It was called MJ-12 in correspondence. When they addressed correspondence to each other, they did not address it to MJ-1 to MJ-6. It was J-1 to J-6, because secretly they were known as the Jason Scholars amongst themselves. Publicly, they were known as the Committee on the Clear and Present Danger. And to my knowledge, may still be known as the Committee on the Present Danger. I remember MJ-12 as being 12 men. However, I am still in the process of remembering, and my memory is constantly being joggled and jiggled. And one of the reasons I may have remembered it as being 12 members on Majority 12 is that they had to have a majority of 12 votes to carry anything into action. Thus, Majority 12. Thus, Operation Majority, thus the Majority Agency for Joint Intelligence. That's where that name really came from. Which means they literally had to have the vote of every member on it, if there were really 12 members. But having to have 12 votes to carry, being named Majority 12 or MJ-12, could have just been enough to make me believe that they only had 12 members. My memory is beginning to joggle now, and I'm starting to believe that maybe there was first 6 from the government and 12 from the Executive Committee of the Council on Foreign Relations, and that there may really be 18 members on MJ-12. Whenever I believe that a correction needs to be made, first, I wasn't going to do this. But that's wrong not to do that. It's wrong to stick to your guns because you don't want to change anything. That's silly. Because, ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't make any difference if there's 1 member, if there's 12 members, or if there's 18 members. What makes a difference is that Majority 12 exists, MJ-12 exists. These men were all members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and they are the secret government. That's what really counts. Now, I'm telling you this tonight, there may be a discrepancy in the number of members because I haven't confirmed it yet. But I know that there were at least 12. Everything else that I've told you about them is absolutely true. But there may just possibly have been as many as 18. When President Eisenhower put this group together,
oh, thank you.
I didn't realize how thirsty I was. When he put this group together, this group, and President Eisenhower may have done this intentionally, but there's no reason to believe that he did, because there's nothing to tell us that he did. But having been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, he may have done this intentionally.
These people saw this as the opportunity that they had been looking for all of their history. It was the opportunity finally to control one of the major superpowers of the world behind the scenes. Because who gets knocked off when things go wrong? The person standing out in front, right? The people behind the scenes just chuckle and laugh and say, they got the wrong guy, and they put another one right up there for you to knock off. If you're even smart enough to knock somebody off. Which we haven't been. The only ones that have been knocked off, they did the knocking off. Through a whole bunch of secret executive orders and NSC memos, which are in fact executive orders, they reached the habit actually of using NSC memos in place of presidential executive orders to prevent the government from falling should the public find out what was really going on. It was to save the presidency. What started out as a means to save the presidency resulted in a means to prevent the president from knowing the truth. Up until President Bush, President Eisenhower was the last president who knew the entire truth. And when he left office, he could see what was happening. He was a very intelligent man. He could not have been the overall commander of all Allied forces in Europe with 5 stars and then reached the office of president. If he had been a dummy. He was not Dan Quayle, I can guarantee you. He knew what was happening and he attempted to warn us when he left office. He told us, quite bluntly and in no uncertain terms, to beware of the military-industrial complex. And who is the military-industrial complex? It is the members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and since the inception of the Trilateral Commission as well. The Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission control the board of directors, the majority of the stock, and usually the president and CEO of all the major corporations in the United States of America, including the news media, the major publishing interests, etc., etc., etc. Usually the president and CEO is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and or the Trilateral Commissions. Many of them have dual membership. The board of directors is always controlled. Council on Foreign Relations and Trilateral Commission members own the majority of the stock. Nelson Rockefeller and David Rockefeller and the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation, which, by the way, the Rockefeller family owns the Ford Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation, believe it or not, own the majority of the stock in the major corporations in the United States of America. They own the majority of the American-held stock of the Federal Reserve, but the majority of the stock of the Federal Reserve is owned by the European bankers. America has been sold right out from under our noses. It doesn't belong to us anymore. It belongs to a secret government, a secret worldwide government, which pulls the strings, which says, we want this to happen here, and it does. We want this to happen here, and it does, invariably. These men are playing a game of chess on a level that we have never imagined. They're playing chess with the world. And we don't know how to do that. We can't even conceive of that. So let's not be concerned with the world, let's just be concerned with our country, because they cannot succeed with the world if they cannot succeed with the United States. And with your help, they will not. Where do the aliens fit into this? I've told you the most important incidents that have happened. Everything else is really trivial. I've told you about the abductions, the implants. I've told you about the mutilations, the body parts being found on the craft. I've told you about the agreement. I've told you that they're here. I've told you that we have their technology. Those are the important things. Whether they're at Area 51 or at Tonopah or down in Alabama, doesn't make any difference. They're here. Invasion is over. It's all over. Don't look for an invasion from space. It has already occurred and is over with. So we don't have to be concerned with that. One of the things that the secret world government is going to attempt to do to get you to accept their new world order is they're going to try to scare the hell out of you with a fake phony landing where they're going to say, oh my God, there really are ETs, it's going to be covered by the media of the world. And they're going to say, we're going to be invaded from outer space, we have to band together as humanity to save the planet. And most people are going to say, yeah, yeah, let's do it, one world. Imagine all the people. Imagine nothing worth fighting for. Imagine no religion. Imagine living only for today. These events are always fun and unpredictable. I'll tell you what, it's time. Let's take about a 5-minute break.
Came up and asked quite appropriately, who the hell are you? And I used to start all of my talks out with who I am, where I'm coming from, how I saw this information, and what my stance is on it. And I eventually reached a point, and I keep forgetting that I'm not in California anymore. I reached a point where people would say, we already know who you are, tell us what you got to say. So I stopped doing that, but now I'm in Arizona, and I realize that whereas in California I'm very well known, here I may not be as well known. I was raised in a military family. My father was an Air Force pilot. He is a retired Air Force colonel at this moment. When I was a child, I heard stories about Foo Fighters and crash discs and things not of this world and strange sights up in the sky, and saw pictures that pilots took simply because I was the son of a pilot. Not because anybody was taking the time to show me, I just happened to be there when these things were discussed and when these pictures were shown and passed around, and usually was underfoot and eventually was kicked out and exiled to the back bedroom or the backyard. Eventually, though, I grew up and left home, went into the Air Force. I was assigned to the Strategic Air Command as an aircraft and missile neutronic technician, which means that I worked on the hydraulics and the pneumatic systems, or high-pressure air systems, of aircraft and missiles for the Strategic Air Command. I worked with B-52 bombers, KC-135, aircraft, which is the same as a 707, only it's for refueling other aircraft and carries fuel instead of passengers. I worked on B-58 bombers. I worked on Minuteman missiles. During the time, both when I was in school learning my trade in the Air Force and the time that I was on the job, I met people who had taken part in crash disk recoveries, and usually at the Airman's Club or in some bar downtown or someplace, because I was a young man then and that's where you could usually find me with a beer in my hand looking for a girl. And if there wasn't a girl around, we lied to each other a lot. And generally these stories I thought to be a lie until later years when I realized that these guys had been telling me the truth, and I could kick myself in the head because I had not written it down
I had not pressed them for more information at a time when they were willing to talk to me for some reason or other. When I left the Air Force, I went into the Navy, and really I planned to just skip from service to service. I was a pretty crazy young kid. I was gung-ho. I was raised on John Wayne movies and Sergeant Rock comic books. I came from a military family. My whole family was in the military service. Uncles, grandfathers, brother, everybody. We were service people. We were government people. We were patriots. We cared. We believed that the best thing that a man or a woman could do was to serve their country. When I went in the Navy, I volunteered for submarines because that was the weirdest thing you could do. And I was pretty weird. And I thought it would be neat to sleep underwater. So I did. While I was on submarines, being junior in the Navy, real junior, I had to stand lookout watches. Lookouts are well-trained professional observers. They are not just someone that they grab out of the galley and stick it there with a pair of binoculars. You are well trained, because before you yell to the officer of the deck that you got to shoot at something coming at you off the port beam, you got to know that that's really the enemy and not the admiral coming out for a visit. That's really the main reason for it. So we were trained observers. Now this is extremely important to me personally, because without this experience I probably would not have lent the importance that the later information that I was going to see, I probably would not have realized how important it was. While on lookout between the Portland, Seattle area and the Pearl Harbor area, while we were traveling on the surface as port lookout, I saw a craft the size of an aircraft carrier exit the water at a range of approximately 2.5 nautical miles off the port quarter. The port quarter is approximately 45 relative degrees off the port bow. Port is your left. Left port wine is red. That's where the red light is on a ship. Okay, now we got through that. I was stunned. I knew that I had just seen something that was absolutely incredible, and nobody in the world would believe that I saw it, and nobody else saw it. And I was faced with a dilemma. I'm the port lookout. Something just came up out of the water that could destroy us in a second. It was a machine. It was intelligently guided. I knew this. It was as big as an aircraft carrier. It was the most important, earth-shattering thing that had ever happened to me in my life. Because I saw it, I realized what it was, I knew I wasn't dreaming, there was nobody around who could be manipulating me in any way, shape, or form, and it was my responsibility to report this. Are you kidding? I'm gonna tell the man who writes my performance report that I just saw this thing come out of the water? You gotta be nuts. But I had a responsibility to the safety of the ship. The boat, which we call submarines, boats, not ships, to the boat and to the crew. So I had to devise a method to report this. And what I did was I told the officer of the deck, Ensign Ball, said, Ensign Ball, I saw something about 2.5 nautical miles off the port quarter, but it just flashed and I don't know what it was. Could you please help me scour that area to see if we can find it again? Now, I didn't really believe that this thing was going to show up again at all. Well, the starboard lookout heard this conversation, and he turned around and started looking too, which he shouldn't have done, because you're never supposed to desert your own field of responsibility, but he did. At about that time, the object came, or this object, or another one just like it, came back down out of the clouds and entered the water. Ensign Ball dropped his binoculars, dropped his jaw, and turned around and just stared at me and didn't say a word. And then he turned back around and he just stared off into space for a couple of minutes, and then he turned around and looked at me again and he said, this had to happen on my watch. Okay. call the captain to the bridge, which on any naval vessel means that there is an emergency in progress. You do not call the captain to the bridge unless there is an emergency situation, unless his presence is needed. If you call the captain to the bridge and his presence is not needed, you are in deep, deep, deeper than the submarine will dive to trouble. And it's lucky they didn't have submarines in the old Navy when they keel-hauled people. Now, the captain came to the bridge, and so did the chief quartermaster, because it was his job to come to the bridge with the captain, with a 35-millimeter camera, anytime anything like this happened. This event repeated itself several times over a 7 to 10 minute period, and we watched it. They would exit the water, go and disappear in the clouds, and then another ship, or the same ship, would re-enter the water. Eventually, it stopped. We were told by the captain before we left the bridge, not to discuss it with the other crew members, that it was classified top secret, and that we were never to mention it to anyone. Now, the crew knew about it. How they knew about it, I don't know, but I suspect that it was picked up on sonar and radar also, in which case the sonarman and the radarman would know about it too. And I believe that is what has happened, and I believe that they were also told not to talk to anyone. But several crew members came up to me and wanted to know if we really saw a UFO, and I told them that I was not allowed to discuss what happened, and I didn't know what I saw anyway. So that was the end of that. I did tell a good friend about it years later. When we arrived in Pearl Harbor, an officer from the Office of Naval Intelligence came on board and debriefed each one of us independently of the others. I do not know what went on in the debriefings of the other personnel involved, but when I went in, he began to ask me what I saw. When I began to describe to him what I saw, he became very upset, even enraged. And having come from a military family, having a father who was an Air Force pilot and an officer, having served 4 years in the Air Force, I knew what this man wanted to hear. It was obvious to me. So I told him what he wanted to hear so that I didn't have to go through with what I knew I would have to go through if I told him anything else. So I told him, sir, I did not see anything. I don't know what you're talking about. And he said, that's the spirit. I had to sign a security oath. I was dismissed, told that I was a good sailor, had a good future with the Navy, and I left. On the way out, Seaman DiGirolamo was braced up against the bulkhead in the passageway, and I whispered to him, tell him you didn't say anything. And I don't know whether he did or not, because we never talked about it again amongst ourselves. Several years later, I was trained again. Well, in between this, I struck, or striking is what you call trying out for a certain particular job. I was striking for quartermaster, which is navigation. It's where you navigate whatever ship or vessel you're on. I made it, was promoted to third class quartermaster. Eventually was promoted to second class quartermaster. I was then trained by Naval Intelligence in my secondary NEC, which is 9545, which is internal security. I was then sent to Vietnam, where I was given a multi-million dollar patrol boat. I was given 5 other lives to take care of and mother and be a friend to and be a daddy to and everything else, and was given a river and everybody that lived on both sides of that river and said, Bill, go out and kick their butts. And while you're out there, try to collect as much intelligence as you can, try to learn as much as you can from the local people, try to make friends with them, keep the river safe and secure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. While I was there, I learned that there was much
UFO activity in Vietnam, an awful lot of UFO activity. They were called, in official reports, helicopters, enemy helicopters. Well, anyone who knows anything about Vietnam, if you look in documents released about Vietnam under the Freedom of Information Act, you will find many reports of any enemy helicopters attacking our troops, attacking the enemy's troops, taking villagers away from their villages. The truth is, ladies and gentlemen, North Vietnam had no helicopters, period. It was really UFO activity. When I came back to the United States, I was assigned to the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet and was specifically assigned to the intelligence briefing team for Admiral Bernard Clary, who at that time was the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet. While serving in this official capacity, I had occasion to prepare briefings on flaps. You know what a flap is? I mean, something's happening right now, and it's very important, and everybody's concerned about it, and all the admirals are in the command center, and they want to know what the hell is going on, and they want up-to-date information, and they want the plots correct, and they want to know who's over here, and what's the closest ship, and how fast can we get a United States Marine unit there. That's what you call a flap. In other words, everybody's throwing it all in the fan, and it's all coming out on me and the other people who were with me. It was our job to provide this information on a 24-hour basis. And specifically every day, we would come in very early in the morning, about 4 a.m., and we would prepare a briefing, which took place at between 8 and 9 o'clock, whenever the admiral was ready, because we didn't tell him when to be there. He told us when he was there, and when he was there, we had to be ready. Between 8 and 9 o'clock, usually, we would present a briefing to the admiral and his chiefs of staff. Now, you have to remember that this man had reason to know what was going on in half of the world, because he's literally responsible for the Pacific Ocean and the Indian Ocean and everything in between, including the land masses. In case of a nuclear attack or nuclear war or any kind of a war, it is the United States Navy that will deal the primary blow to the enemy, will deliver the war to the enemy first, and will usually carry it through to the end. And that is the truth. So he had the need to know everything that happened in that part of the world. When alien-connected incidents occurred, we would get top secret messages marked MAGIC, restricted information. That is not an obsolete security classification. And the first time it was used was not in the Nixon years. It has been used on alien connected material since the beginning. So don't believe everything you hear. When we got these messages, usually all hell would break loose. It was of the utmost importance. When we were briefing officers who were new in the position that they had the need to know regarding this flaps, we sometimes had to brief them on the history that led up to this incident. So then I had access to documents containing the history, until eventually I found in my hands a document called Operation Majority and another document called Project Grudge, which contained the most astounding information I have ever seen in my life. And from that day forward, my life has never been the same. It has not been normal in any way. And I wish that it had been somebody else who had seen the information. But because no one else has had the guts to stand up and talk about what they've seen, I'm kind of glad that it was me, because I do have, and I will continue. Because you need to know what was in those documents and what's happening. Now, if I had not seen the UFO with my own eyes first, I would have thought that this whole scenario that I saw in these documents was a hoax. Not perpetrated by the Navy or the Office of Naval Intelligence or the United States government to fool me or to fool anybody else in the Navy. I would have thought it was a hoax
after I had read Operation Majority that outlined the plans for the secret government, the secret world government to come into power, I would have thought that it was a hoax to scare you into bringing that about. And I still think that they're going to use it to try to bring it about. And I want to warn you beforehand not to believe a word they tell you when they tell you there's going to be an invasion from outer space. Because there's not going to be. It's already taken place. Because I saw what I saw on board that submarine, and because of the research that I've conducted since then, I know that it's real. It's not a hoax. It's not something to propel this world government into position. It's real. There's aliens here. They're just as real as you and I. And I'm here to tell you about it. And there are other people talking about it, and there have been throughout the history of this thing, only, especially in the early years, anybody who tried to talk were killed, were sent to mental institutions, just flat disappeared, and they never knew what happened to them. Or all of a sudden, Joe Blow was working in a garage, and now he's got a nice job in the government, making three times what he was making in that garage, and he doesn't talk to you anymore. Those things were commonplace. They have still been commonplace up to the present time, except in recent years, people are starting to learn how to prevent it from happening. And one of the ways is you get squarely in front of the public and you stay there. Because I'm going to tell you this right now, and you can bank on it. You watch me every day of my life. If anything happens to me, you don't have to do any more research. You know damn well everything I'm telling you is true. And they don't want you to know that. So they're not going to touch me unless they can make it look like an accident where you will believe that it's an accident. And I'm telling you right now, they know how to make people die of heart attacks, strokes, brain hemorrhages. They know how to make people fall down the stairs. They know how to make people commit suicide, or at least look like they committed suicide. And if you don't believe that, look at what happened to the 20 material witnesses who were close enough to the car to see William Greer shoot President Kennedy within 2 years of the time it happened. They're all dead. The odds of them all being dead is something like 300,000 trillion to one. Some of them apparently, I say apparently because that word means that's what it looks like, committed suicide. One died of a karate chop to the neck. Several of them had heart attacks, etc., etc., etc. One man hung himself. They were all murdered. All of them. They were murdered by the Central Intelligence Agency. William Greer was the assassin who killed President Kennedy. He was a Secret Service agent. I'm going to show you the film here shortly. Many of you wonder, well, if that's really true, how come Jackie Kennedy never said anything? If the Secret Service, the highest protective body in the United States assigned to protect the President of the United States, just shot President Kennedy, who in the hell is she going to tell? Me? I can't do anything except tell you. The FBI? J. Edgar Hoover is one of the men who ordered his assassination. He was a member of MJ-12. You beginning to see the picture? The picture's not a pretty one. Rifle in the closet. And no one could ever successfully march against an armed population which believed in themselves. We've lost a belief in ourselves. We've lost an understanding of the Constitution. We've lost the meaning behind it. We don't understand what our country is. We don't understand what keeps us free. And the secret government is manipulating you daily into begging them to take away your freedoms. And some of you here in this room have been begging them to take away your freedoms. You've been asking them to take away your right to keep and bear arms, which is the only thing that keeps them from destroying the Constitution, declaring martial law, and forming this world order right now. The only thing preventing that is the guns in our closets. That's all, because they would have done it years ago if it had not been for that. Many of you right now in this room have been screaming for the government to take away some of our freedoms in order to get the drugs off the streets. You've been saying, I'm willing to give up some of my freedom to get rid of this terrible plague. Let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it is your government who imports those drugs and who is selling those drugs to your children, and has been from the very beginning. And the only ones that they ever catch or allow to be caught are those who are in competition with them. This operation was put into place in the late 50s. It was organized by George Bush in cooperation with the CIA while he was president and CEO of Zapata Oil. Their plan was to bring the drugs in from Central and South America to the offshore oil platforms of Zapata Oil, from there to bring them into the United States by the normal crew conveyance and helicopters. Therefore, they would not have to undergo inspection by custom officials or law enforcement agencies of any kind. And it's been going on ever since. Today, the drugs do not enter this country by the little planes that they would have you believe on the 6 o'clock news, nor by the little boats that they say are speeding across the Caribbean. The Coast Guard, ladies and gentlemen, and the United States Navy are not inept. Every aircraft that approaches the borders of this country from any direction is monitored minute by minute by the North American Air Defense Command. The drugs, ladies and gentlemen, are brought into this country on CIA proprietary contract aircraft and military aircraft, and land on CIA facilities in the United States, and on military air bases, and Homestead Air Force Base is one of those bases where those planes land. Recently, Colonel James Bogreitz, in the last few years, went to the Golden Triangle area to try to bring back American prisoners of war who we know are still being held. We've always known it, the government has known it. They have misused the Officer of Prisoner of War, the Office of Prisoner of War Accountability, to transact these drug deals. So they don't want the prisoners of war to come home. Well, we didn't know that until Bogreitz went over there and talked to a gentleman by the name of General Kunsaw, who is the drug overlord of the Golden Triangle. I've talked extensively with Colonel Greitz about this. I have all of his information. And coupled with mine, it paints a very bad picture. General Kunsaw says that every year, government agents, high-level government agents, are purchasing 800 tons of pure heroin and shipping it into this country from him. He wants to stop it. He is willing to stop it. He wants us to give him a crop substitution program so that his people do not have to raise poppies and process heroin in order to survive. He wants to become a recognized real nation rather than an illegal group of bandits living in the jungle. And George Bush and the United States government says there is no interest in doing that here. He's willing to stop 800 tons of pure heroin from coming into this country every year. And George Bush says, we're not interested in doing that here. Furthermore, we're not interested in hearing who these government officials are that he says he's selling these drugs to. Furthermore, Colonel Bogrides, if you don't shut your mouth, we're going to lock you up in a federal prison and you're never going to get out. And they tried. You see, it was the United States government that sent Bogrides to Southeast Asia to bring prisoners of war back. Colonel Bogrides is the most decorated man to come out of Vietnam and one of the most decorated heroes that this country has ever had. They sent him in there because of that, and they gave him a lot of press. And every time he went in, they warned the enemy beforehand, usually by Radio Free America, in their own language, warned them by name who was coming, how they were coming, what route they were going to take, so that they would not be successful. But it made the administration look good because they were sending somebody over there to do it. But every time he went, he had to use a phony passport that the Department of Defense gave him to use to accomplish his mission. So I'm going to show you a short tape right now. I want you to pay a lot of attention to this, please.
I think I missed some. What was it the federal prosecutor said on the courthouse steps? It's important that we covered that segment of this talk because it leads directly into something that I'm going to cover next. The purpose of the importation and sale of illegal drugs to the American people was to finance the alien-connected projects and other black projects which they knew they could not take to Congress for funding. For two reasons. One, everything they were doing was illegal under the Constitution and Congress could not, in all ethical and moral standards, approve those projects or approve funding. The second reason was they believed, and with some rightfulness, that if they told Congress, it would be the same as telling the public. What happened next, or a few years later, is of profound significance. It is one of the most heinous crimes that this secret government has ever committed,
and ranks, in my estimation, right alongside the sale of drugs to our children. And that is the assassination of the President of the United States. There have been three presidents who have left office directly because of action of MJ-12, one of them by murder, assassination, however you want to dub it, it's all the same thing. President John F. Kennedy found out somehow that the CIA was behind the drug smuggling and the sale of drugs to the American people. And if you'll remember correctly, that was the years that the hippie movement began and the flower children began to come out. And they were looking for answers because they were disillusioned. And one of the answers where they found solace was drugs. And President Kennedy was a very idealistic man. I think when he took the presidency, he fully intended to play the game until he discovered the weight of the position and the importance of the position and the trust that the American people placed in the president. And I sincerely believe that he and his brother sat down and decided that that was going to be the first honest presidency. They attempted to get rid of corporate crime, organized crime. He attempted to do things right. He was idealistic. He was charismatic. The people followed him. They loved him. We still love him. What happened to him was a terrible blow. I was sitting in a barracks. I had the, what you call the watch. And part of the watch was so boring that I was actually watching television. And what I was watching was the Kennedy motorcade in Dallas, and I was on an Air Force base called Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls, Texas. And what I saw was a man whom I believed in with all my heart, struck down in the street by a hail of bullets in a most undignified manner. And I cried. And I'm not ashamed to admit it. The tears came out of my eyes and I couldn't stop them. And I felt a great emptiness in my chest. And I knew at that moment that the world had changed and would never again be the same for me. And it never has. But I didn't know then what I was to learn later. What I was to learn later is I read in documents prepared by the Office of Naval Intelligence, and how did they know? Because they had a part in it. President Kennedy was ordered to be assassinated by MJ-12 because he had discovered that the CIA was importing and selling drugs to our children, and he ordered them to stop it. And he told them, if you don't stop it, you're going to be sorry because I'll stop it and you'll all pay the price. Well, they didn't like that. They knew they would lose a lot of money. They knew they would not be able to accomplish their objectives. The second thing he told them is, I want you to implement a plan to reveal the presence of aliens on this earth to the American people within the following year. They didn't like that either, and they thought it was premature. They had already done a study which indicated that the American people would panic, that the panic would lead into anarchy, which would cause the collapse of the government, that our religious structure would collapse, that a large segment of the people would begin worshiping the aliens, that our economy would collapse, the stock market would collapse. They had doom and gloom and dark clouds for everything. I don't believe that will happen. And it certainly, in my estimation, did not justify the murder of the President of the United States. That it was an exploding pellet and not a bullet, and they would have found fragments of that pellet, and they would have found large amounts of toxic shellfish poison in the brain, which was exploded into the brain when this pellet did its thing. And it would have said, CIA, 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 because the CIA had that type of weapon at that time, and it was well known. When they finished doing that, They surgically repaired the wounds to make it look like he was hit from behind, and then they took photographs of these repairs. Then they took the body in to be autopsied as if it had come out of the Bronx casket. They also altered the throat wound. We know this. Kennedy's brain was taken out of the room where all this occurred on a gurney, covered with a cloth, and when people asked what that was, being wheeled down the hall and the gurney covered with the cloth, because everybody wanted to know what the hell was going on, they were told that a woman had delivered a stillborn baby, and that was the stillborn baby. It was not. It was Kennedy's brain. Checking the records and doing thorough research, we have found out that there was no stillborn baby in Bethesda Naval Hospital on that day, or the day before, or the day after. Witnesses ask what the other casket was doing in the room. They were told that an army colonel had died and the casket was prepared for him because he had died that day and the family had requested a quick burial. Checking the records, an army colonel had not died in that hospital. In fact, no one had died in that hospital that day, and an army colonel had not died in that hospital for some time. Don't kill Mr. Greer. I want him to talk.
Okay, we're ready. Thank you.
I don't hold much hope for William Greer talking, but I want him to talk. I don't want him killed. I want that man to talk. I want him to become a man and talk. I want the rest of these so-called men and patriots in our government to become real men and real patriots and start talking. Because right now, I'm going to tell it in front of you, I'll tell it in front of the world, I'll tell it in front of the government. Our top military commanders are cowards and they are traitors. The men who represent us are cowards and traitors, and they're all afraid to talk. They're scared to death to talk. They'll let the country go down the tubes before they'll stand up and do what a man should do. And what our history demands that any man who calls himself a patriot do, stand up and talk and tell the truth. And I'm going to continue, and I'm going to ask that you continue with some of the things that I'm going to ask you to do tonight when you leave here over the next few days and into the next year. I'm going to ask you to continue until we clean up this government, until it gets back to a government of, for, and by the people. Now I'm going to show you the Kennedy assassination tape. I want you to watch it very closely. And if you can't see it, we'll run it again. And if you still can't see it, we'll run it again. I don't care how long it takes, because you need to know this. You need to know who killed your president, and you need to know why. And you need to be incensed, you need to be outraged, you need to know that you have the power to do something about it, and then you've got to do it. You have to do it. And I'm going to give you this challenge. If you can't do it, you ought to go live in another country.
Let's see here.
Years ago, the people of the United States and the world were shattered by the impact of an assassin's bullet upon the helpless, unsuspecting young president of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Watch the driver, not Kennedy!
Bullets has penetrated deeply into the body and soul of America, destroying the very lives of thousands and the heart and trust and political will of literally millions. And the years that have passed since this tragic event removed from the world stage perhaps one of the most promising human agents of peace and progressive political development, we have been fed one officially sanctioned lie after another, beginning with a blue ribbon cover-up commission to a castrated Senate Select Committee seeking to shed light upon an event deliberately enshrouded in deception, concealment, and outright falsehood. 25 years is long enough. It is time the truth was finally told, and the earnest hope that it will truly set us free of the murderers who pose as our protectors. What we're observing here is the motorcade in Dallas on November 22, 1963. As the presidential car passes behind the freeway sign, President Kennedy is struck in the throat by a bullet that was fired from the grassy knoll. As he's grasping his throat, John Connolly is turning around to his right. He, at that point, is struck. You notice the passenger of the car turning back to see what has happened to the president. As he turns back to the front, the driver of the car turns with his left arm over his right shoulder with a pistol and fires. You see the .45 caliber, nickel-plated automatic weapon. In his left hand, he's firing over his right shoulder. You see it in relief. You see his head pointing backwards towards the president. In this enhanced close-up,
watch her eyes. She looks right at Greer.
Of the bullet upon the president, the force of the shot drives him violently backward against the back of the seat. You see Mrs. Kennedy react in horror. The ugly, gaping wound, which is evident here, according to many observers at the scene, was actually created on the print. This was not the actual nature of the wound. But you notice that Mrs. Kennedy wasted no time in trying to exit the vehicle, because she clearly was able to determine exactly where that shot had originated. And it was her personal bodyguard, Clint Hill, another Secret Service agent, who attempted to keep her in. What the air was indicating here is what appears to be the outline of a man, a hat, and his rifle. The arrow is pointing to the rifle barrel of the man in the bushes who possibly was the rifleman on the grassy knoll who fired that shot. Another view taken by another photographer. Again, you see Mrs. Kennedy trying to exit the vehicle from behind, being pushed back in by her bodyguard. A number of witnesses on the scene rushing towards the vehicle. The man standing on the far right of the wall there is Abraham Zapruder, the photographer who took the original photos. The arrow here is indicating what was very likely the rifleman on the grassy knoll, the man who fired the shot which penetrated Kennedy's throat from the front, not from behind, as the Warren Commission would have you believe. Very interesting note also that the motorcycle policemen were told to remain behind the car at all times. Here you see the passenger in the front turning back, looking at the president. Instead of jumping back to assist him, he turns forward. The driver is now rotating. The weapon comes into view and he fires. You'll see this repeatedly in these sequences. Kennedy's been shot in the throat. He's leaning to his left. The driver now begins to rotate. His left arm comes over his right shoulder and he fires now. Again, you see the driver rotate. You see the weapon coming into view. He's rotating again, the weapon is in view, he fires. You can clearly see his head turning and his arm and the weapon extending into view over his right shoulder. Many of the witnesses indicated that the car slowed almost to a virtual halt at about this point. And here in the normal version, you see how much more quickly to speed it up. It's much harder to determine. People who ask the question why Jackie Kennedy did not report this, it should be fairly evident that she wasted no time in getting away from the attacker.
Lights, please. Did everybody see it?
No.
Okay, those of you who did not see it, please come up to the front. And would some of you in the front here who still did not see it? Okay, good.
Be afraid that if you do it, you're going to get on somebody's list. You're already on their list. And you're not worth a barnyard chicken to them. You're already on their list. They don't care about you. They don't care about any of us. They will tolerate us as long as we are useful, and that is as far as they will tolerate us. When this one world economic organization comes into power, your Bill of Rights is going to be flushed right down the toilet. And if there's anybody in here who's working for the government and came to find out what I'm going to say today, I want to tell you that those are your rights also, and you're on the wrong side. And they will do to you just exactly what they did to Ollie North and Haldeman and Colson and Dean and anybody else who was loyal to them but became expendable to save themselves, because that's all they care about is themselves. Don't misplace your loyalty. Your loyalty belongs with the Constitution of the United States and nowhere else. It does not belong with me. I'm just marching into battle with you. Maybe right now I'm a little out in front. But believe me, when you start reading on your own and researching and looking into this, you'll run up here with me. I know you will. I have great faith in you. Americans have always been there when it counted. And if I didn't believe that in the bottom of my heart, I would not be up here doing this, because this is suicide without you. But I know you're going to be there. There's a lot of things you can do. You can research, you can write books, as Mr. DeMar has done. You can help in many ways. One of the ways that you can help is start teaching our children what the Constitution is, because they don't even know. And you know something? I'm not going to do it because I don't want to embarrass you, but you don't know either. Most of you in this room can't even tell me hardly anything about what the Constitution says, and you know it. That is the United States. It is our freedom. It is everything that we stand for. It is the only thing on earth worth protecting besides our family and our loved ones. There is nothing else to fight for. There is nothing else that has ever given anybody the freedoms and the chance and the opportunities that our Constitution gives us. And we must never lose sight of that. The Constitution has been taken out of the school books intentionally, ladies and gentlemen. The Rockefeller family owns most of the teaching colleges. Did you know that? They also own most of the textbook publishing companies. Did you know that? Did you know that the Federal Reserve is not an agency or a branch of the United States government, and our money is nothing but worthless printed paper? Did you know that when you pay your income taxes, you pay them to the IRS, which also is not an agency or a branch of the United States government? It is an agency of the Federal Reserve. It is the collection bureau to repay our national debt to those whom we borrowed it from. When you get your refund check, it does not come from the money you paid in. The money you paid in to income tax goes to the Federal Reserve to pay off the national debt. The United States government, to give you your refunds, has to borrow again from the Federal Reserve to give you your refunds, and we go more into debt. And did you know that if we started printing $100 bills right now with all the money printing presses that we have at our disposal and printed money 24 hours a day, every day, forever, we could never pay off the national debt, because we cannot print the money fast enough to even catch up with the interest on the unprinted amount. Our children and our grandchildren and their grandchildren and their grandchildren and their grandchildren and their grandchildren have been bought and paid for and are in debt forever. And our nation is owned by the European banking interest, who own the majority of the stock in the Federal Reserve. We have been asleep at the wheel, and we are teetering now on the brink of a cliff. and one wrong move, we will go over that brink. But if we very carefully get out of this car and pull it back away from the edge of the cliff and get it back on a straight course to our destination, the true destination that we should be headed for, which is peace and posterity and safety and security and love and happiness, then we can survive. But as I said before, I cannot do it for you. I will march as far as I can until they strike me down. You've got to catch up with me. You've got to be with me, all of you, every one of you. If you go home and sit and think the rest of it will do it for you, then there may be somebody else sitting, thinking the same thing, and somebody else, and somebody else. And we might end up with everybody thinking that somebody else is going to do it for them. It's too late. It's too late. The Constitution of the United States and our freedom have never, ever been in greater danger than they are right now. We have never been at war with Russia. Russia is not our enemy. Russia has been our ally since the end of World War II, and I'm going to prove it to you right now. I'm going to show you a video that appeared on 60 Minutes last Sunday. And what did it say? How many of you have been reading in the papers that many of our generals and admirals and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of both countries have been going back and forth? Do you know what they're doing? Have you been watching what else has been happening in the world? They're taking inventory of the combined arsenals and getting ready to merge the two largest armies, navies, and air forces in the world to make this world government come about, and the target date is 1992. And a Russian general says it to Mike Wallace right in the film that they have never considered the United States to be their enemy. And you might think it's propaganda. He was telling the truth. The reason for the guise of antagonism between the two countries for all these years has been to hide the fact and take the public's eye off of what was really going on. And the reason that they kept such large standing armies was, one, to fund large sums of money that they needed besides the dope money and everything else into these black projects, and to keep these large standing armies, navies, and air forces in case the Earth was invaded from outer space. It's all done in secrecy, still being done in secrecy, but over the last 10 years they've been slowly leaking information, slowly they've been telling you the truth. How many of you saw the end of the Olympic Games in Los Angeles? Anybody? Anybody see it on TV or videotape or on the news? This incredible event, the most beautiful, authentic looking UFO you ever saw, came down out of the sky and landed right in the middle of the stadium. It was awe-inspiring. It was beautiful. The crowd went wild. It was shining down the blue beams of light exactly as the abductees described them. It was an exact copy of the real thing. It was sponsored by Levi Strauss. How many of you saw the Levi Strauss Dr. Slacks commercial recently? Where the guy runs in and says, "Hey, guess what, gang?" He's got on Dr. Slacks. "America is hosting EBS." And the guy says, "EBS? What's EBS?" "EBS are extraterrestrial biological entities, and America is hosting EBS." And everybody says, "EBS, jeebies." He told us the truth, but we laugh at it. Not too long ago, Gumby on Saturday morning, your kid was sitting there and you thought he was watching good television. Gumby was abducted, implanted, and returned. And the little boy said, "I wish they'd do that to me." What do you think they're preparing those kids for? What else have you been seeing on TV? Alien Nation, who, by the way, look exactly like the group of aliens designated the Orange. How about War of the Worlds, which plays out the reality of John Lear's Lear hypothesis? What do you think is happening with ET, with V, which is telling us that maybe we may have to resist in just this manner if it ever turns out that one of these guys are bad guys. And what happens in V? The bad guys back a one-world government that takes over the world. And the world thinks it's wonderful, don't they? Until one lone CIA agent discovers the truth. And then people form little resistance groups. Well, gang, let's form them before it happens. Let's don't wait till it happens. Let's do it now. Let's prevent it. Okay? Thank you. I have one other thing that I want to show you, which is about an organization called Yellow Fruit. Does anybody know anything about Yellow Fruit? Okay. Let me show you this.
Like support for the Contras in Nicaragua.
When the
the most severe and scandalous projects ever embarked upon the U.S. military was a project called Yellow Fruit. It was a backdoor CIA effort to aid the Contras in Central America and to perform other operations that Congress never would have supported. And the CIA saw Yellow Fruit and the Special Operations Division as a magical fountain of support with unlimited money, unlimited weapons, black money, black tape transportation capability. Basically, another CIA without any of the reporting or problems that had triggered the problems of the late 1970s. Some of the units actually participated in strafing Nicaraguan targets, bombarding airfields and oil fields in an attempt to disrupt and possibly dislodge the Sandinista regime.
But Tom Golden blew the whistle on Operation Yellow Fruit.
Normally, in intelligence operations, you advanced a certain amount of money to operate with. Once you spend that money, then you must submit a voucher to account for it. What I found was very unusual in this unit is people had been advanced as much as $150,000 and had never submitted a voucher for accountability. I eventually went to my superiors and reported what I believed to be abuse of funds and possibly fraud. That eventually was surfaced to the leadership of the Army, who ordered a massive investigation into the special operations community in general.
This is Arlington Hall, Virginia, headquarters for U.S. Army Intelligence. Here, members of the SOD team were court-martialed in a soundproof room. Two SOD members are now serving prison sentences for financial fraud. But what was most important about these trials was not the discovery of another case of misuse of government funds, but the revelation that the SOD's Yellow Fruit served as the blueprint for what William Casey called the Enterprise.
The Special Operations Division and Yellow Fruit had a unique access to equipment, material, offshore bank accounts, a secret clandestine Army/CIA aviation unit, a clandestine ship overseas to provide transportation, access to material and weapons, all the seeds that would later basically erupt in the Iran-Contra affair and be known as the Enterprise. And I believe that Yellow Fruit and the Special Operations Division were both being groomed by the CIA and the National Security Council to serve as the cornerstone of the Enterprise to perform operations in Central America and elsewhere that would never be accounted to Congress.
Lights, please. Now, let me tell you who Yellow Fruit really is. Yellow Fruit, along with Sea Spray, are accountable for security of the alien task projects. They started out as Delta teams attached to the National Recon Organization at Fort Carson, Colorado. Over the years, as their expertise became known and they began to use Delta teams for other things also, they branched off and became independent from the National Recon Organization and from the United States Army. They then evolved into a split organization, one half of which became Sea Spray, the other half became Yellow Fruit. Sea Spray is responsible for the internal perimeter security of the alien projects. Yellow Fruit is responsible for the outer perimeter security of the alien task projects. If you attempt to get near the boundary of Area 51, you will meet Yellow Fruit. They will intimidate you. They will scare you. They will flash guns in your face on public land where you have every right to be, and they, most people, will go away, which is the prudent thing to do. Now, if you get to the boundary of Area 51 and put 1 foot across, you are now the property of Sea Spray. And no one who sees Sea Spray ever sees anyone else. Where do you think they get all this money? From drugs.
If you look at all of the things that the secret teams have been doing, look at all of the covert operations that we've been performing, and then look at the budget for these things, and you will see that Congress has not even allotted 10% of the money that would be required to carry out what they have been doing. In the words of John Lear, whom I consider to be one of the greatest patriots in this country, wake up, America. You've been had. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
We have information at the back table. We have some tapes. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, this is our only source of income while we continue our research and do this, is the money that we get from people who come to listen to this information and the money, the sale of materials and tapes. When possible, when we have the extra money, we do make tapes which we give out to people for free with the stipulation that they never charge anyone for tapes and that they make at least five and pass them on to other people. If you purchase a tape from us, we want you to make copies and give them free to other people. If you purchase documents from us, we want you to copy those documents and give them free to other people. But we need your help. If you can afford it, please get the information. There's bibliography is attached to the documents, to the tapes. There's not. Be survivable. Would not be able to exist here simply because the projected increase in population, we would not be able to keep up with food supply for the masses of people. The burning of coal and fossil fuels would continue to pour carbon dioxide into the atmosphere along with other pollutants. The burning of sulfurous coal would increase the incidence of acid rain and destroy the forests. The forests are the only thing to keep the balance between oxygen and carbon dioxide. Since then, it's not just acid rain. We have been depleting the forest at an unbelievable rate. There's almost no rainforest left on the face of this planet now. The rate of pollution is unbelievable. At one point, we actually had rivers in this country that would burn if you lit a match anywhere near them. The whole length of the river would burn. It's incredible. There were whole rivers that were nothing but soap suds. We're getting better at doing that. But we've got to get even better and better. We've got to stop using fossil fuel. We've got to stop. We've got to do whatever it takes, even if it goes back to a simpler lifestyle. We've got to do that, simply because the Earth is a very fragile place. The government, the elite have taken care of their own survival in case the Earth does so-called self-destruct. They have places that they can go. Yes, sir.
Is the catalytic converter one of the main contributors to acid rain because it puts out sulfur dioxide?
Absolutely.
Sulfur dioxide is mixed with moisture? Or
yes, to get rid of one pollution, they create another. It's because the only answer is to stop driving cars. That's the truth. And there is a benefit to horses, believe me. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Cooper, given the endangered condition of our planet, of which we're all painfully aware, what is your personal opinion as to the reason why these alien races want our planet?
I'm not sure that they want it. There's no evidence that they've attempted to take it from us. I think they want to live here with us. I think there's things here that they want. I think that they find us mystifying in certain ways. There are some aliens who do not have the ability to love or get angry. They don't have emotions. They are very goal-oriented, very scientific. They go about their business. They don't understand it when we get hurt. They don't understand understand it when we cry. They don't understand it when we love someone. And they seem to be studying that very... so they're devoting a lot of attention to it for some reason. There are other ones who are just here to watch. They're not interfering in anything and won't interfere. They're just looking. They're just watching. They're just studying. They don't interfere with anybody. They don't bother anybody. There are some here doing, unfortunately, some bad things. Yes, sir, in the back.
Yeah, a couple of questions. One might have already been answered. I'm wondering...
Can you speak up, please?
How would the aliens fit in with the one world government? Is there any master plan that they have? And also, do we know really where they came from?
We know what they told us. For instance, the group we have the treaty with told us they came from a planet that revolves around a red star in the constellation of Orion, which we call Betelgeuse. Well, wherever they came from before they came from where I'm going to tell you they came from, they really came from the planet Mars, and they may have come from somewhere else before that. But I know for a fact they came here from Mars. From Mars. We have found, ladies and gentlemen, the remains of an ancient civilization on the planet Mars that have at least reached the Bronze Age. And we have found that someone has been living underground on Mars, and I think it's these people who came here from Mars. The Mars phase is not something new. We knew about that before May the 22nd, 1962. When our first space probe that we sent to Mars landed, before it landed, it had made quite a few revolutions around the planet Mars in the atmosphere. It was a winged probe. It actually landed on the surface of the planet on May the 22nd, 1962. Contrary to what you've been told, we knew and photographed the face on Mars, the pyramids, the remains of cities, and many, many other things at that time. I have a letter here in my briefcase that will confirm that. Yes, sir.
So you're confirming much of the alternative three scenario?
Alternative three is absolutely true. Now, in the book, you will find some misinformation, because as they reveal these things to the public, they also put in things that can be proven false in case they ever want to renege on it. And you have to remember that the first purpose of the contingency plan known as Majestic was to test the reaction of the public to the truth with supposedly true information which could be proven false at a later date because false information is mixed in with it. Does everybody understand how that works? Yes.
Is there any way to tell whether there are good aliens or bad aliens, or is there any way to contact or places to go where you can see them that are, like you said?
I can't take the responsibility of telling you who is good and who is bad because I can't make that determination. There's so much lies and so much deception mixed in with the good aliens and the bad aliens that I cannot determine who is who and what is what and what is the deception and what is reality. And I advise all of you to take extreme caution in making any kind of judgment, because the bad ones will present themselves to you as being good to manipulate you. The good ones will lie to you to manipulate you to reach their ends, which they think is good for you. Some of them have a policy that they won't interfere with you no matter what. They just won't have anything to do with us. Now, somebody sent up a note, says, I am very concerned about the statement you made that there is deception coming from good and bad. What deception is coming from good ETs? Is this possibly a lack of spiritual understanding on your part? No, it's a part of in-depth investigation and questioning and finding out the truth rather than accepting what I hear and what I see. That is what is the result of. For instance, would you say that the good aliens who led the Jewish tribes out of Egypt were good or bad?
Bad.
Why? Didn't they save them? Didn't they lead them? Didn't they give them food? Didn't they give them water? But they saved them, didn't they? Didn't they save them? Wouldn't you say that was a good act?
But how did they accomplish it? They deceived them. They said that they were God. The aliens that came to Earth in the ancient times told the people they were gods. Generally, they helped them. But they deceived them, they lied. I'm not capable of telling what's a lie and what's a deception, and I still believe in God. I still believe in Jesus. I'm a devout Christian. But I know that much of what is in the Bible is of alien origin, because I have done my research, and it is without a doubt that much of our religious history is alien manipulation. I still believe in God. I still believe in Jesus Christ. I am still a Christian. I'm hanging.